Last night, we were having a discussion at the forum on really wither the church. And can the institutional church survive, et cetera. And what I came away from that discussion thinking about is that is that the, and I'm just repeating something that I've been thinking about, is that the source of God's revelation in history at this moment comes from the poor and the oppressed, from those who are marginalized. And so if one wants to encounter God, one has to encounter, you know, the poor and the dispossessed. And nothing should stand in one's way if we understand God is incarnate in that way. And so I'm going to start with a quote of Malcolm X to that, on that topic. No religion will ever make me forget the conditions of our people in this country. No religion will ever make me forget the continued fighting of dogs against our people. No religion will ever make me forget the police clubs that come upside our heads. No God, no religion, no nothing will ever make me forget it until it stops, until it is finished, until it is eliminated. Anytime I have a religion that won't let me fight for my people, I say, to hell with that religion. Now that's a very different understanding, it seems to me, spiritual understanding. It really says that where there is no justice, there is no God. And until we make the just situation, God is not there. And this is, you know, a Muslim speaking to us. Africans and Asians led civilization for 600,000 years. They're the cradle of civilization. They taught us how to paint, how to make pottery, how to use tools, utensils, worship. When the slave trade began in the 12th century, was revitalized in the 12th century, pardon me, the people who were slaves to help with the sugar production were Muslims and Christians. But by the 14th century, they had reached into the sub-Saharan area, and it was Africans that would become the slaves of empire. I've done a couple of presentations on how indigenous people were slaves and how they were basically killed off in these genocidal wars against them, working them to death, or the diseases that rampaged and decimated. You know, I use the figures of De Las Casas, of when Columbus discovered Hispaniola, there were between 3 and 8 million are the figures, Indians, but within, well, by the mid-1500s, there were under 28,000 left. So we're talking about the decimation and that it was not successful to continue in the Caribbean trying to use Indian slaves. And so by 1502, African Americans will land on Hispaniola in the New World. And the resistance began even before that. The resistance began on the shores of Africa. The resistance began on the slaver ships. The resistance began with the Middle Passage. From the English slave ship Robert, where a group of slaves led by Captain Tomba and the unnamed woman who gave her life to try to help the slaves take over the ship. From there to Nanny, the head of the Windward Maroons in Jamaica, a slave herself. Throughout history, to the Montgomery boycott, or the Montgomery Women's Association, when Rosa Parks sat down, was able to have 50,000 leaflets ready within a 20-hour period. This is sort of hidden, that role, and I'll be talking about that. All the way to Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. This resistance has continued throughout history. This no to death, this no to a way of life that would say that some people are not equal to others. This yes to life. And so by 1522, Columbus's son, Diego, has a sugar plantation in Hispaniola. This is within a 20-year period. Within the moment of landing, barely did they get them onto the plantation, then the Maroons began. And the Maroons were runaway slaves who went out and into Indian villages and joined with the Indians, or went into the most remote parts of the islands to escape, you know, the plantation owners who would try to bring them back. So this runaway form of resistance begins almost immediately. With Columbus's son Diego, the slaves burn down the plantation, just burn off the sugar fields. He brings men with him to go out and catch those rebels. They bring them back and they hang them on a gibbet. And they let them stay there and hang as a sign and a symbol to any who would dare resist. But it doesn't work. The resistance will continue. Herbert Aptheker says that, who's a historian, says that in North America alone, I'm not talking about the Caribbean, I'm not talking about other areas, but in North America alone, there were recorded 250 slave rebellions or conspiracies. And I'm going to touch very lightly on some of those. The Maroons that I spoke about, in a sense, put a lie to the myth that Europeans tamed the wilderness. Because it was Maroons that ran off to the most remote areas. And in reading some of these testimonies, it was incredible to learn that they went into areas where the water was so filled with worms. I don't know if any of you have ever, you know, been in a third world country where you've gotten, you know, amoebic dysentery, sort of for openers, or Giardia. I've had typhoid fever. I mean, I've just been sick, and I think, how would people learn? I mean, even now we don't seem to have some clues. I mean, except to give us Bactrim, you know, and that's after you're so sick you can hardly walk. These Maroons had to learn how to purify that water in some ways, and they did, because they would have died. I mean, they would have just been ravaged by illness. They also went out into these reaches, and they were able to cultivate in lands that were, you know, completely difficult to just level certain areas in order to plant. They built elaborate forms of, their strategic sense was incredible. They built elaborate forms of protection in these remote areas so that they had false roads, if the conquistadors came out after them. They had traps, you know, where if they walked past a certain area, they would just be plunged in. They really developed the first forms of guerrilla warfare in many ways, because they had no weapons. So they had to use an ingenuity that seems incredible. So in many ways, one could say that the Maroons tamed the wilderness. In 1695, Palmares in Brazil remains dangerous memory. I mean, for Brazilians, they talk about the quilombos. And this is where, for 90 years, a Maroon community held forth. And in fact, the Portuguese called the Zumbis, who were, you know, these Maroons that had escaped this area. They just couldn't penetrate it. They couldn't. It was very high. And they simply dare not go there. And they called the Zumbis men and women of great courage. In 1721, I talked to you about Captain Tomba on the slaver ship Robert. For a small story, because this unnamed woman who was with the slaves in the ship had access to the upper deck of the slave ship, she was able to walk around and warn Captain Tomba and the slaves below when it might be time for them to strike for their freedom, to try to overtake the ship. And she does that. I mean, I just think of the courage, you know, that this would have taken. She does that and calls them, but somebody had tipped off one of the sailors, and and they were all captured. And Tumble was killed, and so were the other slaves that attempted rebellion with him. There were only a few of them that actually tried to rise up. And they took her by the thumbs and strung her up, and then slashed her back and let her bleed to death, hanging on that gibbet, on that ship, again as a warning. It didn't work. In 1730, I mentioned to you Manny, who was the head of the Windward Maroons on Jamaica. And Nanny wore a string, a necklace, with white men's teeth in it. And this just, she became mythic. Just this incredible leadership of this woman in this struggle against the slavers. When the French Revolution took place in 1788 on the Caribbean islands, particularly Saint Domingo, which would be Haiti and Santo Domingo, and it would later have new names, these masses of slaves there were encouraged by the notion that some people had struck for their freedom. And this just captured the imagination of this sort of huge system of slavery. A man named Buchman sat in a small cabin in the far reaches of one plantation with a candle, and he invited people to come in, and he said, "And what of our freedom?" Soon, 10,000 people had been organized in this quest for freedom. And a footman, slave, named Toussaint Louverture would become the leader, would become the chief for the spark of this movement of slaves for their freedom. And Louverture, whom we know little about, was just brilliant. He was defeated once by the French as he began with the slave army. And then he joined, knowing that the British wanted to begin slave trade again on the island. He nevertheless joined with the British as a Spanish officer to overcome the French. This is called, you know, if there's ever a split in the ruling elite, this is a tremendous advantage for the people on the bottom. So basically they rout, let me see if I got straight, who was first, who won at first, wait. Okay, so Toussaint, as a Spanish officer, sides with the British against the French. And they are able to engage in an incredible struggle against the French, and basically it's somewhat of a stalemate. In the midst of this, Toussaint learns that the French peasants, who now have succeeded in moving the revolution forward, and in Parliament, they've decided that the slaves will be let free in the colonies. And he doesn't hesitate for a moment. He joins the French army. He's made a brigadier general. At which point, with his help, and they haven't been able to do this before, they bring the British to a point where they ask for a truce. Now, still as a French officer, he then defeats the Spanish. It's at this point that Toussaint Louverture writes to Napoleon, and basically we have the first example, not of slave rebellions, which I've been describing, but of where a slave revolt takes state power, which is very different than uprisings or revolts. This means, you know, how do you run a nation, and how do you begin to become a nation state. And it's at this point that he writes to Napoleon and he asks for reconstruction aid. Napoleon never answers. You can imagine why. And to make a long story short, they invite him to France at a certain point, and literally they just revolutionize the society. I mean, in terms of this is a, I mean, I think of this notion of the last shall be first. And so you have a situation in which the slaves and mestizo culture are going to be given lands, are going to be given a voice in government. They invite him to France, and he agrees to go, and he's tricked. He's thrown into chains. And as he stands on the dock to be taken to France, where he will be thrown into prison and where he will die, he makes a speech in which he says, you have only cut down part of the tree of this liberty. You've misunderstood what this has been about. The tree of liberty will flourish. He dies in France within a year and a half, I think it is, maybe 2 years. His captain, Dessalines, defeats the French. So there's just this incredible example, not only, as I suggested, of resistance, but of even taking state power. We probably all know this date, that in 1619, slaves come to Virginia. By 1650, there are more blacks in North America than there are whites. And one always knows when something is getting out of hand, because another tool of the colonizer, if it isn't, you know, direct military suppression, is to use law. And we could have fun with looking at litigation in this country throughout history. But essentially, you know where the mischief is when you look at the law, because they had to make a law that there could no longer be intermarriage between African Americans and white colonists. And of course, the white colonists were much more of the indentured servant class. And it was white women that were marrying African American men. There simply wasn't yet institutionalized the kind of racism, you know, that we've all been recipients of. But once you begin to legalize, you start to codify and institutionalize protection of white privilege. So that that was happening. This one story always to me is symbolic of this notion of resistance. By the mid-1700s in Louisiana, I read this story of a young black boy who comes into a particular town in Louisiana, and some of the rebels who attempted to escape have been hung. And they cut off their hands and they put them on pikes in the road. And as the blacks pass these black hands sticking in the road, it is supposed to be a symbol to stop and to recognize what the price would be of running away or of disobedience, of challenging the system. And for the whites, to a great extent, it's a symbol of control. But for some of the blacks that went past those black hands, and for some of the whites that would join their cause, it was dangerous memory. It reminded them of the price of continuing to try to be faithful to people, of what it means to struggle for liberation, that it could cost your life, of the courage and resistance of the black community. And so those black hands did not become a symbol of stop. They were an invitation that beckoned them to continue the struggle in whatever other form it would take. By 1829, of course I'm certainly jumping, David Walker writes an appeal based on this notion of resistance. Just listen to this appeal. Think how many tears you have poured out upon the soil which you have cultivated with unrequited toil and enriched with your blood. He tells them to go to the plantation owners and to demand their freedom. Inform them that all you desire is freedom. Nothing else will suffice. He then invokes the names of black heroes like Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, who led slave revolts in the South, Joseph Sinque, leader of the slave revolt aboard the slave ship Amistad. He invokes Madison Washington, who led a slave revolt on board the slave ship Creole. He then goes on, in the style of the great black preacher, he ends, "Brethren, arise, arise, strike for your lives and liberties. Now is the day and the hour. Let every slave throughout the land do this, and the days of slavery are numbered. You cannot be more oppressed than you have been. You cannot suffer greater cruelties than you have already. Remember, you are 4 million.
Let your motto be resistance, resistance, resistance. No oppressed people have ever secured their liberty without resistance. What kind of resistance you had better make, you must decide by the circumstances that surround you and according to the suggestion of expediency. Brethren, adieu. Trust in the living God. Labor for the peace of the human race. And remember, you are 4 million. Think of this tradition. It continues. It continues with Reverend Henry Highland Garnett. I was part of the sanctuary movement. And for a long time, I tried to study the abolitionists. And I couldn't get it. Something was tremendously missing. I was studying the white abolitionists, and then I studied the black abolitionists, and then I understood the abolitionist movement. White abolitionists were powerfully preoccupied with guilt over the sort of, they wanted to reclaim the pristine goodness of the nation. And black abolitionists said, this is impossible. We want to save lives. Very different notion of what it meant to be an abolitionist. So the moral preoccupation, I mean, it was, a horrendous task. I mean, the soil was filled with the blood of slavery. Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, same thing. Well, I'm very embarrassed. I just read you Henry Allen Garnett. Now I'm reading you David Walker's Appeal. Sorry, folks. Both are abolitionists, nevertheless. Remember, Americans, that we must and shall be free, and as enlightened as you are. Will you wait until we shall, under God, obtain our liberty by the crushing arm of power? Will it not be dreadful for you? I speak, Americans, for your own good. We must and shall be free. I say, inspire you. You may do your best to keep us in wretchedness and in misery, to enrich you and your children, but God will deliver us from under you, and woe, woe will you be if we have to obtain our freedom by fighting. Throw away your fears and prejudices, then, and enlighten us and treat us like men, sick and women. And we will make you more than we do now, and we will like you more than we do now hate you. And tell us now no more about colonization, for America is as much our country as it is yours. And then there was the resistance of women, from Harriet Tubman to Sojourner Truth, to the mamas who worked constantly washing and ironing in order that they could buy their children out of freedom. We'll never know those stories of the black mamas. To Milla Granson, who ran a midnight school from midnight till 2 a.m. after the day in the fields, to teach the people to read, a subversive act. To an anonymous slave woman who, when she went into Massa's house, because she was a house servant, they would spell in front of the slaves, for whom it was illegal to learn to read and write. And she would memorize the letters and tell her grandpa, who had learned to read at a certain point. Can you imagine? If I were to start spelling things, could you? Sentences, and she, perfect. To another young woman who would lay underneath the Massa's house, and as they would read the newspapers, she would memorize the news and run back to the slave quarters and tell them what was happening in the country. This thirst for knowledge that was denied because it was a form of power. In 1851, a year before the Fugitive Slave Law, which will be declared unconstitutional later, a year before that, a minister named Reverend Lewis Hayden in Boston, in the Boston courthouse, sweeps into the courthouse to take Shadrach, a slave. And they take him, it's an incredible story, they take him over their hands and walk out of the sweep out of the courthouse with him, place him not a carriage, but I guess it would be like a wagon and a horse, and take him out. They're all arrested later. And
The jury's got to decide on their guilt or innocence. I mean, now this would be later under this new fugitive slave law. And one person on the jury holds out and says they're innocent. Can't convince them. They're acquitted. He was the guy that drove the wagon. I mean, just this continual subversiveness on the part of those whites who would side with this struggle, freedom struggle. Carrying on this notion of resistance, Frederick Douglass. I think this is quintessential. I think this is an instruction for our lives. And I think it is a theological lesson, but it has to do with the question of power. Hope I've got the right page this time. You've heard this. It bears repeating. The whole history of the progress of human liberty shows that all concessions yet made to her claims have been born of struggle. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are those who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. In 1871, under the Reconstruction period, blacks are given political power. Given. Remember what Douglass says. It must be taken. And so there are black mayors. There are two black senators. There's a first black woman lawyer. There's an African-American Harvard graduate for the first time. Political power is given. Tell me if this isn't familiar. Think about civil rights. No economic rights. And so blacks never get their 40 acres and a mule. They're brought into debt slavery, and so it's just a new form of enslavement. By the 1890s, what doesn't work again, as we've said, you know, through war or military might, the state will use law. And so there's a legal rollback of the gains of the Reconstruction. I mean, just think of civil rights in the 70s and the rollback of those civil rights gains until you meet the 80s, where social welfare since Roosevelt is just decimated, just torn asunder, shredded. And so...
Is that where sharecropping came up? The sharecropping, is that the...
Yeah.
Where you're not, you don't own the land. It's
right,
just another
right. So by 1883, the 14th Amendment says that all have civil rights and that no state can discriminate. But it doesn't say individuals within the state can't. So the South develops a whole pattern of segregation that in which they legally institutionalize. I mean, we're talking about, Jim Crow laws, aren't we? And even law will legislate in terms of segregation, but will turn a blind eye to what essentially becomes murder. I mean, lynching is so massive that Ida B. Wells, by 1901, is a journalist who courageously begins to tell this story, and she does it, and after Ida B. Wells, Mary Church Terrell begins to do this writing because a black man daren't. And so she begins to document from 1878 to 1898, 10,000 blacks are lynched. And these are the ones she can document. You know, there's that incredible song of Nina Simone called Black Fruit Rotting on the Trees, you know, which is just a symbol of those lynchings. So the explosions will come then, what James Baldwin says, the fire next time, always coming back. By 1919, after black men come back from being soldiers in World War I and recognize they come back with the same patterns of discrimination, race riots begin. Another form of resistance is recognizing that the South stole Reconstruction. Between 1920 and 1940, 7 million blacks will migrate up north, into what becomes another form of chattel slavery, but it's economic. There are northern ghettos, which become forms of internal colonies within empire. And so they will be locked into this kind of servitude. Again, this idea of political rights are given but not economic rights. By 1956, the black freedom movement until 1972 will explode. With the Brown versus Board education, a lot of this history is familiar to all of us. By sort of rereading and learning about civil rights, you see again that there's this tendency to not recognize women's role in those struggles. For instance, when Rosa Parks sat down and all history moved before her and was just too tired.
Can't we have 5 minutes?
5 minutes, maybe.
Please.
Well, when she was in jail that night, the Montgomery Women's Improvement Association, led by Joanne Robinson, had already attempted to have a boycott. And the moment just hadn't been there. Those women had, by morning, 50,000 leaflets on the streets. I mean, you want to talk about where the organizational structure is? Go to the moms. 50,000 leaflets were on the street. We don't even know that. And in fact, R.D. Nixon, who was the head of the NAACP, who was actually Rosa Parks' boss, there's this incredible speech he gives, and I wish I could repeat it, but when something like this, he went over to two young ministers on the other side of town. They knew they had to have some respectable, legitimate voice of the black community, and they went to two young ministers, Abernathy and King. And he said to them, "What are you boys going to do? We want a boycott." And they said, "Well, my God, the white community, I mean, is that strategically correct? I mean," and this speech is incredible, he says, "You know, those women have been working for you, they've been on their knees, they've been scrubbing your floors, and you're going to tell me these women are saying they want this boycott, and you boys are saying you don't know what the whites are going to do?" Well, there's this incredible quote in which King says, "We figured we're either going to face black women or the white establishment, and we chose the white establishment." So King says, "I'll do it." This is a little different read, you know. Ella Baker was an organizer from New York, would come down south because she said, "I want to see," I wish I had this quote, but it was something like, "I want to see when the poorest of the poor rise up." Ella Baker, God, if you ever want to see a movie, see Fundi. Fundi means teacher in Africa. It'll break your heart. God, she's just one of our heroines. We hardly know who she is. Ella Baker comes down there, and it's Ella Baker that says she will become the person who creates Southern Christian leadership. She's the secretary. She's the person who puts together. She does the Xerox thing. She holds it together. She tells these guys to come to meetings. After the success of the Montgomery boycott, Ella Baker goes to Martin Luther King and she says, "You can't stop. We've got to move forward. What's the next action?" King says, "The people are exhausted. They need to celebrate. What a victory. This is historic." She says, "If you're a good organizer, you never move. Carry it forward. You can't let the momentum has to go forward." She pushes and pushes and pushes, and King finally concedes. When the SCLC, we all do this, organizational hegemony, sees that there are a group of students who are sitting in at lunch counters, that's going to be core, and it's going to be later, and that this group of students are having a powerful effect in city after city because they're willing to face clubs and dogs and carry these principles of nonviolence forward. They call a meeting and they come together with these young people. And, you know, they wanted them to become part of SCLC. Ella Baker comes in and she goes off to the side with these young people. She organized the meeting. So she knew people, you know. She was on the phone. She sent the letters. She said to the young people, she said, "You know what I love about you?" She said, "You have a decentralized," because boy, she knew the other part. She said, "You have a decentralized sense of leadership. You're trying to do this thing in a very egalitarian way. And she said, you want to keep that. You have something to offer us. She said, I don't know if you should be part, this is her organization. This is the humility, I think, that is just incredible to me. She says to them, stay your own organization. And so SNCC is born. Two organizations, and how many of us have ever heard? SCLC SNCC, Ella Baker is there. Students loved her. I don't know what those guys thought when the students came back and said, well, we think we'll just, we're going to call ourselves the,
Student Nonviolent Coordinator.
Well, I'm going to try to just go this far and no further. By 1963, there are 930 protests that take place in the South, 115 cities. They fill the armories, they fill the jail. In Birmingham, Bull Connor is the director of public safety. We know the famous letter that comes from a Birmingham jail from this young minister who's in a leadership role. There, during the voter registration time, there arose a woman who, for me, is just a sign of hope and inspiration. Her name is Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer had worked on plantations in the South. I don't know if she had 20 kids, I can't remember. She and her husband decided, yes, they will be leaders in this new effort to call the people out of the back roads, the deep South, and call them to vote, call them into history. There's a story of she and her husband with the kids lying on the floor because KKK had shot through the windows maybe 25 times. She's picked up during one of the protests, and one of the things she says is, the only thing they could do to me was to kill me. And it seemed like they've been trying to do that a little bit at a time ever since I can remember. She tells the story of her own mother in the fields. She just weeps thinking of her mother from you know, dawn to dusk, being in those cotton fields. And Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, just an incredible woman, gave so much to this movement in terms of her leadership. And there's a story of she and her friend Annelle Ponder. And they had been picked up, arrested, thrown in a southern jail, and she'd been beaten up pretty badly. And her friend Annelle Ponder, who didn't have the sort of verve and strength of Fannie Lou Hamer in terms of just her physicalness, I don't mean in terms of her spirit. She was in the cell next to her, and it took about 24 hours to get a reporter into the jail, because they'd always have ruses, to try to get the story out. And this reporter went in and saw Fannie Lou Hamer, and she told her what had happened and how they had interrogated them and beaten them up. She said to her, what can I do? She said, well, she said, I'd like you to go next door to my friend, Annelle Ponder. She said they beat her so bad that she can't talk. She can't move her jaw. Her lips were just, you know, just bruised. She said, I just want you to give her a little bit of encouragement. They'd like you to go next door. And the reporter said that she has to go into the cell next door. And she walked in and she saw this woman, and she said she just wanted to weep because her lips were swollen, and she just looked at her and she said she couldn't talk. And she said to her, I know you can't talk. Don't try to do that. I just want you to know we're here. And she said the woman looked up for her, and she only had one word to say. Freedom was all she said. Well, I guess I'm going to end this. Do I have a minute left?
Yes.
I'm going to quote Malcolm X now again, and then quote Martin. This is just before Martin. Malcolm X will be killed in 1964. He's speaking to Brother Earl, and he says, I always knew it would end like this. Brother, I'm sorry I never had a chance to tell you about my father. He too tried to help the people and was hunted down and finally killed by the powers of the day. Now I know how he must have felt, with a family and all. Don't look so sad. I'm no stranger to danger. I've lived with danger all my life. I never expected to die of old age. I know the power structure will not let me.
I know that I have done the very best that I could do to help our people. I did not want an organization that depended on the life of one man. The organization must be able to survive on its own. We are living in an era of revolution and revolt of the American Negro as part of that rebellion against oppression and colonization which has characterized this era. We are today seeing a global rebellion of the oppressed against the oppressor, the exploited against the exploited. So very much like King, absolutely, not because they were psychic, not even because of their sort of spiritual sense of a life well lived, but a clear understanding of what the price and the cost of faithfulness to their people would be. Well, King, we know this. I think we all know that the moment that Martin Luther King is killed is not so much when he continues to struggle for political rights, but it's the moment when King begins to see the links between economic rights and political rights, and he begins to say, this is an empire. And what you're doing in Vietnam, and he links the fate of people of color together, and he says, what you're doing in Vietnam, you know, it's not a struggle over democracy and freedom. It's a struggle over who will have control, both geographically in terms of, you know, the oil finds off those coasts. And so King is really killed, and I think in terms of just his humanity. I think when I read this, I just had a whole different notion of what courage Martin Luther King had, because at the moment of that that famous night when he gives his talk before he will be killed the next day at the Memphis garbage worker strike, King at that moment is told, he's spoken out against the war in Vietnam, he's linked black people's struggle to the struggle of all peoples of color, he's really using the word imperialism, he's no longer simply struggling for civil rights. And it's not because he's been pressed by the Stokely Carmichaels or the other radical blacks. I mean, he's seeing this himself because he resisted a great deal of that. But now he's been told, the night before this is to happen, by his own leadership, they've got their own, you know, intelligence network comes in and says to him, look, Martin, we don't know if it's the Teamsters, we don't know who it is, but you can't involve yourself in these kind of strikes. I mean, blacks in a labor strike, that's a whole different kind of a threat. And it could be the Teamsters, but they're saying they're going to take you out if you go out on the strike. Others of his people come into him and they say, Martin Luther King had a whole series of affairs outside his marriage. And they come into him and they say, Martin, you know the FBI's got tapes. They've got actual tapes. They've got you, Martin. Your leadership is moral. If they expose this, it's over for you. Imagine this. And this guy's really tired. All he says at that moment is, I'd rather die than be afraid. And he gives that talk when he says, I've seen the mountain and I'm not afraid. Incredible, that kind of a courage. Up against that, and he goes forward. Last talk, Martin now. The dispossessed of this nation, the poor, both white and Negro, live in a cruelly unjust society. They must organize a revolution against that injustice, not against the lives of the persons who are their fellow citizens, but against the structures through which the society is refusing to lift the load of poverty. The storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth, from which there is no shelter in isolation or armament. The storm will not abate until a just distribution of the fruits of the earth enables men everywhere and women everywhere to live in dignity and human decency. The American Negro may be the vanguard of a prolonged struggle, a struggle that may change the shape of the world as billions of deprived shake and transform the earth in the quest for life, liberty, and justice. I think that instinct is simply the voice of history. I was listening, you know, to our forum last night trying to figure out what are we to do. And it seems to me that one of the things we are to do is to remember we are not the vanguard. It is going to come from the dispossessed people of color. It is not going to come from us. And they'll lead us forward.
I have some sheets on which there are definitions of racism, several different definitions of racism. They may help, they may not help. But I'd like to ask you if you would code racism. Now, let me tell you what a code is. And there's all kinds of different ideas of what a code is, but basically a code is used sometimes when we've been really struggling with definitions or we've been really struggling with notions that it appears we understand, but there's sort of some almost deeper, more symbolic ways in which we can get at these notions. In other words, if I were to ask you to codify racism in this country, any form of it that you want, it might help us to understand that in a different way. Now what happens is, a group of people codes, they're coders. They make up a code, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute. And then the rest of us decode. Our task is to say what that code meant to us. There's no correct code. In fact, if you're a good enough coder, what you're trying to do is code reality, you know, not make up something interesting. You're trying to get at reality, and if you do it well enough, we will probably exhaust what you've said because you really got us into the reality, and it'll go way beyond what you thought. Or it'll go off in a tangent that you didn't think. So it's not like there's an answer. I say that because sometimes when I do this with students, you know, they sit there no matter what I tell them, and the people are, you know, sort of coding, and they're going, well, you're hot, that's close, you know. It's not the point. The coders say nothing. They listen when we decode. It's our task at that point, we as the audience. Now, one time I was, one of the codes, we were trying to get at the question of what blocks, what keeps us from sort of liberation. And this is just a student's code, I'm just going to give you an idea of it. And one of the things I say is that codes are not necessarily verbal. They can be. They could be like a play, they could be a skit, they could be a poster, they could be a symbol. They could be a movie, we can't do that. But I remember I asked students to just, you know, code what's blocking us, and we had been talking about that and talking about this, just, you know, sort of a cacophony. And then they did this code, and they went out, and they talked for a while, and they came back in, and we all sat there. And it was kind of incredible. They got a mirror, a small mirror, and they taped the dollar bill across it. And they didn't say anything. They just walked up to each person. And you had to look at the mirror, but in order to see yourself. And they just... And then they sat down. Well, it was incredible what came out of that. I mean, the depths at which people began to understand, you know, take that notion. Another time they were dealing with homelessness, and I don't know where they came up with this, but they asked everybody, it was very cold in February in Chicago, and the freezing night, and they asked everybody, and they just said, you know, everybody go out, and came back in, and they said, take off your shoes. They didn't take theirs off. And everybody, you know, you go along with anything. And within about 15 minutes, they were freezing. You know? So they just did a whole thing about difference in society and, you know, in this very small way, people were able to recognize that some people had power to decide and also, you know, what it means to not be, you know, not have all the things you need. These are small things. There's a couple of examples here of codes of racism. I don't know if they're helpful or not, but you know, those aren't mine. But it's just whatever you imaginatively would like to do with this notion of racism.